This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. More than 37,000 Walt Disney World Resort employees, represented by the Service Trades Council Union, will see the pay go up over the next 3 years. The union says it's an historic agreement which will raise the starting pay to $15 an hour. Walt Disney World says the increase will provide a powerful boost to the local economy. So when Disney raises its pay, will other companies follow? What does it mean for the broader economy in Central Florida, and is $15 an hour enough to live on? Join the conversation. We're on Twitter. You can send us a tweet, comments and questions at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio is Gabrielle Russin. She's a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel covering the tourism industry. Thank you so much for being here, Gabrielle.
Thank you.
Also joined by Eric Clinton. He's the president of Unite Here Local 362. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Thank you.
And with us by phone from Gainesville, Hector Sandoval, Professor of Economics with the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Florida. Thank you so much for joining us, Hector.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
And you can also join us as well. We'd like to hear what your thoughts are about the raise going into effect over the next 3 years. Maybe you're a Disney employee. Maybe you're thinking of getting into that line of work, or maybe you're at one of the other theme parks. We'd like to hear what you think. We're at WMFE on Twitter. You can send us your tweets. Gabrielle, I want to start with you. You spent the last few days, and of course before that, kind of covering this deal. It's been hailed as historic by both Disney, by the unions. What's the mood been like? What was that mood as those members voted over the last couple of days in Orlando?
People were really excited. I was hanging out with union workers, and they were, as they were casting ballots, and they were cheering and chanting like they were in an Orlando City soccer match. I mean, they were just really jubilant last night and very excited about their new contract.
How did it kind of compare to negotiations in the lead up to this, though? Because I know it hasn't all been smooth sailing. It never is with a contract, right?
Oh, no. It was pretty intense. I mean, their labor talks have been going on since summer 2017. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've seen Disney workers protesting outside the theme parks as they were rallying to get higher wages. You know, the union even filed an unfair labor practice complaint in a dispute they were fighting with Disney over these $1,000 bonuses that had been promised. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was pretty tense. And Disney workers rejected Disney's earlier contract in December. So this was the second time they were voting on a contract proposal. So very, very long, drawn out.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the denouement of it. Eric Clinton, from your point of view, a lot of hard work's obviously gone into this. I mean, just put this in context. What does this deal mean?
It's life-changing. For our members to spend so much time engaging with their employer back and forth, to have a say at work, and then to win like this, I just know it's going to really lift people out of a very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Give us some examples of how it might help. I mean, $15 an hour, it sounds good. And obviously, if you're making $10 an hour or something, that's like, you know, 50% pay increase, as Disney and the unions have said. What does that actually mean for somebody who's just starting at that wage level?
Well, it means a pathway to a new living situation if they're in transitional housing or homeless. It means auto repairs or even a new car. I mean, you know, over the next 6 months, workers at $10 an hour will get $2.50 in wage increases. If you're a full-time worker on a 40-hour work week, that's $400 extra a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's a car payment. That's school supplies. That's an extra trip to the grocery store, too. That's life-changing.
Eric, you have been with the union, just talking off there before we started the show, you've been with the union for a number of years, right? But you started kind of in the shoes of a lot of these folks who are now pretty jubilant about getting this wage increase. What is it like sort of looking back and thinking about your situation when you started working at Disney?
Yeah, I worked at the Great Movie Ride at the Hollywood Studios back in the late 90s. I was making $5.95 an hour. I didn't think that was enough back then, and it was very difficult to, buy lunch sometimes, the small things in life, and to spend so many years and to get to know so many different types of cast members from all over the world and see them win this way together with all of the unions is really just very impactful and very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Gabriel Russin, what about some of the stories? What are some of the stories that have stood out for you over the last couple of days? I mean, you've talked to a lot of these folks. Are there some kind of stories that have really grabbed you and stayed with you about what this means for these employees?
Yeah, last night I was talking to an Animal Kingdom attractions employee, and she was telling me sometimes she works 90 to 100 hours a week, and she needs overtime because her regular shift just won't pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty astounded by it. I mean, that's a lot of hours to work. I talked to another woman last night who's been at a custodian at Epcot. She's been there almost 36 years. She's been there as long as the theme park has existed. Mm-hmm. So I think the people that have been there for a long time and really care and love their jobs, but we're just really excited to have, a higher pay.
Mm-hmm. And if you do have a job where you're on your feet all day in the heat of summer, that's pretty tough, right?
Oh, yeah. And dealing with millions of people coming to the theme parks every year. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hector Sandoval with the University of Florida, I want to bring you into this conversation. I mean, Disney and the unions are calling this a game changer. Disney World is such a big employer in Central Florida. What do you think the ripple effect of this might be?
I mean, first of all, I think this is a great news for all the workers in Disney World. But this is also going to bring a very important and positive spillover effects to the Central Florida's economy. Because, I mean, this increase in the earnings, I mean, this is almost, by October 2020, I think this is going to be almost a 50% increase. And this is clearly, as Eric mentioned, this will help the workers to make ends meet. And this will also, I mean, kind of for the local economy, this will stimulate the consumer demand, also the business activity, and this will also create more jobs. But also something to mention is, well, this will also, I mean, help the workers outside the union because, I mean, it's also likely that they will get an increase just because now the unemployment rate is actually very low in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
So the labor market is getting tight. And, I mean, we as economists, we are expecting an increase in wages since I don't know, last year, a couple of years ago. And this has actually happened very slowly. So I think this is great news for the workers and the local economy down there in Orlando.
Right, but just the kind of market reality, as you say, if there's a bit of a shortage of labor at the moment, it totally makes sense for an employer, whether it's Disney or anyone else, to jack up their wages a bit because they have to, otherwise they're not going to get the workers they need.
Yeah. I mean, this is the unemployment rate is every month there is a lower unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, we were expecting this increase in wages, and then for me it's kind of okay. Finally, we are saying we are looking something, right? We are looking something, and you mentioned before, I mean, Disney is one of the largest employer, and this will actually have a very positive effect on the wages of the other people around.
Mm-hmm. I want to just bring in a comment from a listener here. Audrey writes into us on Twitter, "I am wary of this contract. What did we give up for the $15 wage? It has been near impossible to find the contract in its entirety before the vote. Transparency is necessary. I bet health benefits cost increased dramatically. What else goes? Hashtag vote informed." Eric, I wonder if you could shed some light on that. I mean, how much work went into making sure that members knew what they were voting for, and I wonder if you could address some of those concerns that this one listener has about what the other parts of the contract are as far as healthcare and other benefits.
Well, first, I would say we gave up nothing to win this economic package. Certainly, there are going to be some work rule changes. Some of them are positive, and some of them are very minor.
Mm-hmm.
I know change is difficult for people, but there will be change. There's been change in every contract. That's how this works. In terms of transparency, the full details of the contract have been posted on our website, along with Unite Here Local 737's website for over the last week. In addition to that, we have a very active Facebook page. I get notifications all day long,
mm-hmm,
about people commenting and posting, and we very much have that. So I've never heard that person's name before. I don't think they've probably ever been to an actual union meeting. So, I just think we need to do a better job of informing everyone. But we certainly worked very hard to make sure our members were informed of the deal.
Some of the changes you mentioned, I mean, are there a couple that you can highlight?
Yeah, there's a change into how people will be able to clock in and clock out. There'll be a change in terms of the frequency in which someone can transfer. There's also going to be clarity on holidays. There's improvements in the bereavement leave language. Around discrimination, we've added gender identity to a list of things that you cannot be discriminated against in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Gabrielle, I'm just thinking about the impact of increasing wages and also the sort of demand for labor in Central Florida right now. I don't know if you've been to some of those hiring fairs, but you know when Disney advertises for jobs, they get a lot of applicants, right? People line up to sign on for these jobs. And just judging by your comments about some of the folks you've spoken to who've been there for decades, I mean, once you get a job at Disney, sometimes it's something you want to hold on to for a long time.
But sometimes they have trouble hiring. I mean, they've had $500 bonuses for some positions like lifeguards or hotel housekeeping or bus drivers. So sometimes it can be hard to fill mm-hmm. positions as well, especially when there's so many jobs in this tourism industry in Orlando.
Does it tend to be the more transient jobs or the seasonal stuff that they have a hard time finding the folks for at Disney?
I've seen some seasonal and I've seen some that are like a bus driver, kind of more low-skill jobs that are sometimes hard to fill,
mm-hmm.
and housekeepers. And when there's so many hotels and places that, you know, are competing for those positions. I mean, there might not be a lot of people that are out there.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the other theme parks or some of the other kind of entertainment businesses in Central Florida, like, for example, Universal? What's your sense, Gabrielle, of what the impact of this wage raise at Disney might be on those companies?
You know, the last time Disney and the unions agreed to raise wages, Universal and SeaWorld also raised their pay. I think they set a minimum wage of $9 an hour following Disney when Disney set it to $10 mm-hmm. by 2016. So I think a lot of people are saying that, you know, Disney's Central Florida's largest employer, you know, to be able to compete and hire workers with Disney, a lot of other companies are going to have to raise wages as well.
So it's kind of like when the price of a ticket goes up at Disney.
Sure, yeah.
It goes up at SeaWorld and Universal and vice versa as well.
Disney raises their theme park tickets February. You know, Universal followed suit pretty quickly this year. So, mm-hmm.
Here's another comment from James. He writes in, I believe we will see full-time job cuts for attractions and foods. Disney will become managers. Not sure what that means exactly. A handful of trainers. The rest will become a college program. There will also be seasonal for summer and holidays. I predict more outsourcing. Well, on that note of outsourcing, Eric, what are your thoughts there? I mean, is this something that maybe an employer like Disney might be thinking about?
We already have other work rule protections in place in the contract that determine how many hours a full-timer is guaranteed. That's 32 hours a week they're guaranteed as a full-timer. And in terms of how many casual workers, non-full-time workers, there's protections there as well.
Mm-hmm. Hector Sandoval, if I could come back to you for a moment. I mean, thinking about the sort of this idea of a rising tide lifting all ships, if you will, there has been a lot of effort put in by state leaders in Florida to diversify the economy, to bring in more sort of high-tech, good-paying jobs. What does it mean, though, when you have a company that has so many workers at the lower end of the scale, the service sector, raising wages there? Just kind of to that end, I mean, is that sort of maybe a response a little bit to the efforts at the top to kind of diversify and raise wages? How do you see that picture?
I think it's correct to diversify. And I think if we can learn about the last recession, so actually, during the last recession, the Florida was hit harder than the economy of the country as a whole. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because the economy in Florida depends a lot on the tourists. And most of them are domestic. I mean, the great part of the tourists coming to Florida are domestics. And during the Great Recession, they were not able to travel. So that's one of the reasons the economy in Florida was hit harder. And then it comes like the idea, we want to diversify so that during the next recession and whenever there is a downturn in the economic activity, at least we will be a little shelter from all this, right, depending on the tourist. And that point of view is kind of correct because although you can ask an economist, will not tell you when will a recession happen, everybody will tell you that it will happen sometime, right? So there will be a downturn in the economic activity. So diversifying is important. It's also an important strategy for the business model in Florida. But, I want to point out that, for the people working in this industry, this lift in the wages, this is actually a very positive and this is a great news for all the people in this sector.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that that folks, you know, at the union level have said is that, and Eric mentioned this, of course, you know, some of the basic things like transportation, housing, obviously groceries, just getting that extra $4 plus in your paycheck per hour does make a big difference to that. And of course, in Central Florida, Hector Sandoval, things like housing, that's been a big challenge. So, some 37 plus thousand employees now getting that much more in their paycheck. Do you see this kind of having a bit of a bump on effect to people being able to pay for rent, for example, and what might that mean for that sector of the economy?
Yeah, this is going to be almost a 50% increase, and actually there is the research has shown that these increases in the minimum wages, it's actually improve a big range of other outcomes. For example, they reduce the cost of consumer credit, reducing poverty. They also reduce employee turnover. They improve worker productivity. They also reduce their reliance on public safety net programs such as the food stamps. And this is kind of one of the effects that we are going to see there. It's going to spill over in many many different outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And Eric Clinton, I guess that's something that folks visiting Disney might not be thinking about, right? You've spent a lot of money to go to a theme park. You're in the happiest place on earth. You're not thinking about where the people sort of punching your ticket or serving you food are having to struggle to buy food themselves.
Well, it is the happiest place on earth, and certainly was last night when we approved this contract.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of the fantasy that Disney provides to people. They take you away from that reality. Unfortunately, our members have been struggling for so long. This will change that reality. It's going to change all of Central Florida. The fact that money that's going to be made here is going to stay here. It's going to go into the local restaurants and auto mechanic shops, beauty parlors, all these things that our members have not been able to take advantage of will now help lift up all small businesses.
Mm-hmm. Just want to read another comment from our listener, Audrey, from earlier. She writes, I'm not against change by any means. Wages definitely need to increase, but cast members are still some of the few still benefiting from low-deductible health insurance. Hope this is great news all round. I wonder if we could pull the curtain back a little bit on just how you get a deal like this done, Eric. It took a while to come together. How hard is it to get 38,000 plus people to agree on something like that? And before you answer that, I want to just play a little bit of sound. Here's David Sherwin. He's a professor and director at the Cornell Center for Innovative Hospitality, Labor, and Employment Relations.
They have a long reputation of working well with the union. They ask a lot of their employees, have a magical day. And there's different ways to go about your union management relations. When you have a mature relationship like Disney has with Unite here in Orlando, you're trying not to fight, and you're trying more to get along and keep things going. Disney's an outrageously successful company, and you really don't want to have picket lines.
So that is David Sherwin there with Cornell University. What do you make of that, Eric? Does that kind of gel with your experience of trying to get this deal nailed down?
I think his take on the relationship is pretty right on. In times it has not been a partnership. I think today it has been. But, every relationship struggle makes it stronger. All kinds of relationships, that's the case. And we certainly have struggled with Disney over the years to get to this point. I feel it's a new day in terms of our relationship. I'm really happy about this moving forward. I think we certainly earned this victory, and they also deserve a lot of credit for putting what we estimate to be $1 billion in wage increases over the next 3.5 year period into the local economy. That's tremendous.
You got to figure that's going to come back to them probably more than that, though, right?
Yes, they're a very profitable company. I mean, they make $9 billion last year in profit. They're still going to do very well. And you know, someone said that they expect a lot from their cast members. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Our cast members, our members, are tremendous employees.
I wonder how much Gabriel Rasson kind of image management is part of this, though. I mean, just that notion that you don't want to have picket lines outside the gates of Disney or any theme park, right? And we've seen quite a bit of that kind of activity at other theme parks, SeaWorld, of course, being a pretty prime example here in Central Florida. What do you think of that idea of just making things kind of look good and Disney wanting to make sure that there isn't that sort of sense of disruption for people visiting the park?
Sure, although I think a lot of SeaWorld's picket lines might have been PETA, but
right, sure.
I think there are a lot of employees, you know, when you go to Disney, you know, you see employees that are just really upbeat and friendly, and you don't know what kind of the challenges they're facing back home. You know, one of the women I talked to that has been a custodian for years, you know, when she goes home, she's raising her two grandkids and she's 67 years old. So I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there were some comments in the article you wrote about how she's going to spend some of her pay raise by taking her kids shopping, shopping, rather.
So, I think, you know, I don't think the union employees want to pick it. I think they want to be working, so.
Mm-hmm. Eric Clinton, with all this said, is this kind of a moment to rest on your laurels? Is there more work to be done?
Oh, no. There's no resting. We have a lot of work to do. You know, Disney is a union island and a non-union sea as it relates to the hospitality industry. There's lots of hotel and food service workers throughout Central Florida that will, of course, benefit from the wage increase, but there's so much more that comes from having respect at work.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do that. Gabby keeps mentioning the custodian. Her name's Evelyn, and she works over in Future World at Epcot. I've known Evelyn for, you know, 15 years, and her story of she is Central Florida. You know, she's helped Disney for 36 years at Epcot, you know, become so profitable and successful, and now she's going to benefit from that as well.
Mm-hmm. That idea, though, of Disney being a union island in a sea of non-union, you know, employees in Florida, I mean, it's an interesting notion. Do you think there could be some momentum for getting other unions going or getting other industries signed up? Is that something that you're thinking about?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I actually think, you know, this is going to impact, of course, the hospitality sector, but it's going to impact other places as well. Anywhere that has a custodial worker, somebody that's responsible for cleaning an office or a school. You know, if Disney's going to be paying $15 an hour for that, or a housekeeper at $17 an hour, that's going to be their new starting rate. You know, if it's a hospital or a school, they're going to also be competing in that market. It will have an impact outside of the hospitality sector as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that sort of what you're hearing as well, Gabrielle?
You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. There's so many. I'm so curious to know what the effect will be from, you know, other unions or other people's wages, but also what happens to consumers. You know, Disney Disney Company has a bottom line and they have shareholders. Does that mean they're, you know, I talked to one tourism professor who wondered if, you know, they're going to have increases on hotel rooms or where, you know, where, because Disney's not going to, you know, Disney has a bottom line. They don't want to lose money. Mm-hmm. If they're paid more on employee wages, Where are they going to make that up from?
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be interesting to see if that happens as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gabriel Rasson is a reporter at the Orlando Sentinel. She covers the theme park industry, among other things. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're also joined by Eric Clinton. He's the president of Unite Here Local 362. Eric, thanks for coming by.
Not a problem. Thank you.
And Hector Sandoval, professor of economics at the University of Florida's Bureau of Economic and Business Research. Hector, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Up next, an interview with K.D. Lang talking about her groundbreaking album, Ingenue. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. K.D. Lang released her groundbreaking album Ingenue in 1992. More than 25 years later, the Canadian singer-songwriter is on tour with the album. She'll perform at the Dr. Phillips Centre for the Performing Arts in Orlando this Saturday. I caught up with K.D. Lang earlier this week.
We're playing the record in its entirety in sequence. And, you know, given the fact that the audience members, hopefully, have had a relationship with the record for 25 years, I deliberated for a long time about how to approach it and how to deliver the record. And I came to the conclusion that really just to offer it sort of in a neutral fashion, that doesn't mean unemotional, but sort of just without over-intellectualizing it or over-modifying it, really just kind of delivering it honestly, because people have their own relationships with the record, and I didn't need to challenge that. I just wanted to let people relive their life with it.
What about the band you'll be playing with? Are some of those folks the same musicians you've been performing with for the last 25 years?
One of them is the original bass player on Ingenue, David Pilch. Yep. But the rest are kind of younger. I've played with a few of them for 10 or 15 years, but they're a little bit younger.
Mm-hmm. And what's their experience like then of playing these songs? Like, are some of them coming to some of these songs completely new? Is it something they've grown up listening to?
Probably a little bit of both, but you'd have to ask them. If it was up to me, I would just say they were all just stunned by the genius of it, but I don't know if that's true.
What about the audience then? What about your audience specifically? How do you think that they have changed in the last 25 years since the album came out?
I think they've matured. Obviously, I have a lot of LGBTQ members in my audience, and I think that their life has taken a big turn in the last 25 years in terms of acceptance and, you know, integration. But I don't know. I think every individual is different, and I never take that for granted.
So what do you listen to when you're not performing? What are your musical inspirations right now?
I would say mostly jazz. I listen to a lot of jazz. I listen to a lot of 40s music, 40s jazz, 40s crooners, traditional pop, classical music, and I listen to eclectic contemporary music. So radio stations that play eclectic mixes of new releases.
Do you think what you listen to has changed a little bit, the way you deliver some of these songs, which have been around for so long?
Yes and no. I think I've kind of settled on to the fact that I have my own style, whether it's right or wrong or good or bad, that I am who I am, and that I think it's probably better that I don't try to appropriate somebody else's style. So I just try to sing it honestly and straight from my heart.
Sometimes you bust out some covers, though, right? Especially of some of your fellow Canadian artists. Are there some favorites in your repertoire?
I do. I put a record out a few years ago called Hymns of the 49th Parallel, which was a look at classic Canadian songs or the Canadian songbook. And my three top songwriters, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, and Leonard Cohen. And that's always feels so good to get to that part of the set to deal with these massive songs written by the masters. To me, they're the contemporary masters.
So you grew up in Alberta, right? What were you listening to growing up?
A lot of classical, because all of my siblings and I studied classical music, so a lot of classical piano. In my young teenage years, I listened to a lot of Linda Ronstadt, Emmylou Harris, Joe Cocker, Cream, Blind Faith, people like that. And then I sort of started getting into Kate Bush, Ricky Lee Jones, and Joni Mitchell, that kind of thing.
Do you feel like there's another genre you would try down the track, or something else you might turn to? Like, would you ever release a classical album or a jazz album?
I hope so. But I struggle with being derivative all the time. I don't. I it's doesn't sit well with me, so I always try to find some new way into a genre. So I, you know, it's the hard way, but it's the way that sits best with me.
And I mean, how do you feel about performing an entire album from start to finish? Like, do you feel like that you've spent kind of enough time away from the material that you can come back to it with fresh eyes or fresh ears and give these songs some new life or a new interpretation?
Well, at the beginning, it was very painful because I wasn't sure, you know, when I listened for the first time in many, many, many years to the record, I was like, oh man, this is not going to translate. But thank goodness I have really, really classy musicians and inspirational musicians, and they took it to a new level. And, you know, it's a mindset. It's definitely a mindset. The audience has to be prepared to get into that mindset. I have to sell the mindset to the audience. It's a bit of a, you know, a meditative a record, a meditation on love and heartbreak and so forth. And it's a trip, for sure.
That's KD Lang. She'll perform her album Ingenue at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts this Saturday. Still to come, how do you talk to a tiger? We visit a big cat reserve in Osceola County. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. How do you talk to a big cat? Do lions know how to count? And can you really tame a tiger? Dr. K. Simba Wiltz has been figuring out the answers to these questions for about 16 years. He's the CEO and Senior Vice President at the Central Florida Animal Reserve, a big cat sanctuary in the heart of Osceola County. When we meet at the reserve, he's dressed in khakis and a hat, a two-way radio clipped to his belt. Through the mist rising off the ground, you can see tigers roaming inside their enclosures.
Likely we'll get some tiger language here. Hi, Charger. So that noise that you're hearing is formerly known as Preston. We just call it a chuff. The tiger that we're talking to is Charger. So we're probably about 3 feet away from a 400-pound Bengal tiger. He's standing, roughly about 2.5 feet at the shoulder. Although if he were to stand on his hind legs, he would reach probably about 8 feet into the air, well over the height of a human.
He's kind of like making purring noises, like a domestic cat almost.
Almost, although this is a unique sound. Only tigers make this sound. And they only use this sound usually in a greeting. So that's a hello. But they use the chuff in the same way that we use the word love. Whereby you can love somebody, you can love pizza, you can love the way people drive, depending on the context. And this, in this case, is very much a hello. He has been one that I've been around for the entirety of his life, and he recognizes me, of course, but also many of the other volunteers who have been around him throughout the course of his life. That's the one thing that really becomes special about working with them, is that they do have a recognition of those that care for them.
And where did this fella come from?
Charger was actually born in the organization that predated us, and he was actually a breech birth, which was a rather interesting day. The mother was having problems getting the cub out of the birth canal, and so she allowed us to assist with this birth, hand assist an unsedated tigress with the birth of a breech birth cub. It was a rather special moment.
Now, this other tiger that's wandering over is a different breed of tiger?
Yes. This is Masunkala. He is... hi, buddy. Masunkala is a Siberian tiger. And Siberian tigers are larger than the Bengal tigers. And so Masunkala is about 3 feet at the shoulder. And when he lifts his head up, he's... The tip of his nose actually reaches a little over 4 feet. So if you're 5 feet tall or otherwise, then he's basically looking you straight in the eye.
Wow. When you greet these tigers every morning, what goes through your mind? Because they're, you know, they're magnificent creatures. They seem pretty friendly. But these are big, strong, wild animals, right? So what, you know, what's going through your mind as you greet them in the morning?
Well, the first thing that you have to do is know that you have to respect the tiger. It's been a long time of establishing relationship with them, and each one of them is different. They all address the world in different ways. For me, I've been doing this with this population for almost 16, 17 years now, and so my greeting of the cats has kind of got a very different purpose. It's never just a hello. Everything is an examination. What is their attitude and spirit? What is their injury status? Is there any change from the last time that I greeted them? All of that becomes important because they are such tough creatures. They don't tell you often what's going on with them. So you have to use a lot of deductive clinical reasoning to figure out whether or not everything is okay. And it's also, of course, an honor. You can't force a cat to like you. You have to let them choose their people. And just as there are cats that certainly prefer others, it's always great to feel like they prefer you.
So there are some similarities in big cat behavior and domestic cat behavior.
Absolutely. The thing is that people like to try and make comparisons between big cats and small cats. And from a behavioral standpoint, it often can look very similar. But from there, it starts to become a lot deeper. Each cat brings its own personality and culture, but they also bring the natural tools, talents, and predilections to act on those personalities, and that's where things get fun. So now we're meeting Joaquin, another big white tiger, but he's a really big guy. And you can almost hear it in his chuff. He's got a wonderful chuff, but even laying here, he is just his body length is about 6 feet or so.
So he's a bit bigger than some of the other animals we've just taken a look at.
Yes, indeed. So he is probably around 500 pounds, probably in excess. And when he stands up and he puts his head up, his nose is definitely about at the 5 foot level. So he's one that will look you in the eye, absolutely, when he decides he likes to get up. This is kind of also an interesting view of the differences in size. You know, Joaquin, here he's getting up. Joaquin is one of our biggest tigers, who is paired with one of our smallest. And they come in all different sizes. So Honey, the little one up there, she's might be 300 pounds.
She's kind of petite compared to this guy.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, she's the older of the two. Even though this guy and she did not grow up together. They were peer grouped at a later time based upon personality and the need for companionship. And even though they don't breed, they do need to have others that they're with because it helps stabilize their psychological state and gives them the chance to have the physical affection that they can from a species that can actually handle it.
In another enclosure, we meet a lion named Cola. The cats are talking to each other.
Yes, so we had a disagreement up front with a couple of tigers, and tigers disagree by barking at each other, and lions respond to sounds in the distance by responding with their own pride numbers. And so this was kind of a call and response between species.
So they were checking off.
Pretty much. And lions can count. This has been proven in the wild. And if you think about it, a huge survival skill. If you are a rival pride and you're miles away and you hear a pride sounding, you're going to want to know how many lions that is to know whether to run or whether to stand your ground.
Towards the back of the sanctuary are two of the chattiest big cats, a couple of Siberian tigers called Angel and Gabriel.
Where's Gabriel? There he is. So the thing that I had mentioned before is that not all cats like people. And so it becomes very important for us to provide safety and shelter for those cats that are a little bit more nervous and hesitant around people. And these two are definitely ones, very loving, but they don't like to see a whole bunch of strangers, so they get to be in the luxury suites back here. Full service without all of the attention of the general public. for me, Gabriel? Hear the sound of what it sounds like to get licked by a tiger. Yeah. Thank you for the kisses. They've got extremely, extremely rough tongues, so even though it sounds and like a fantasy to be able to be kissed by a tiger, it's really a lot like being abraded by wet sandpaper, heavily gritted.
What got you interested in working with big cats in the first place?
I've always had an interest in big cats, even from young. The initial thing that got me interested was when there was a canine distemper outbreak in Kenya around 94. That actually led me to learn a lot about lions and disease vectors and really about their society. It led me into my professional career. I am trained as a pharmacist, but have actually made part of my career learning about the big cats, and have gone hands-on in 2001 and have been doing it ever since.
So this location is quite new. It's bigger than what you had before. Just explain the shift from Cocoa, where you were before, to where we are now in St. Cloud.
In order to really reach our educational goals, we had to expand. These cats have a tremendous value to society. They have a tremendous educational value as well as a social value, and we were not able to accomplish it there. That combined with the issues with the Brevard Board of County Commissioners, where we had to move, it really all added up to having to find a place that we could build something that was going to be more akin to what we were trying to get for the cats.
So you had more buy-in from the local government here?
Osceola County is a very agriculturally friendly community, and the local community has been great in terms of embracing us, and it also eliminates the issues of neighbors or other people who may not actually want to be around the cats. It's kind of the balance that we have to strike in order to have them exist within a human society.
So you've got a bunch of enclosures. They're essentially like sort of large open-sided barns with some wire, obviously, so the cats can't get out and people can walk around and see these cats?
Yes, so we do guided tours, and part of the reason we keep them guided is it enables us to tell the stories of the cats and really emphasize the educational value of it. Seeing the cats by themselves is neat, but when someone who understands and is highly educated about them can point out small details, it really brings the reality of their existence home, and that's what we want people to take away from it.
How many cats do you have here?
We have 22 cats currently.
And how much does it cost to run a place like this?
We cost about $15,000 a month, and it's a very expensive venture. Because they have a lot of special needs. Our population is older, so veterinary care is highly specialized and often necessary. So we exist entirely off of philanthropy from private individuals. There is no state or federal funding that supports this kind of work.
I imagine the bill for food is a significant portion of that tally you mentioned, the $15,000 a month. How much does it cost to keep these cats fed?
Well, keeping in mind that they can only eat meat, so that means chicken, beef, pork, horse meat, if it is available, we're talking about anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000 a month. And in the winter months, when they eat more, it can be more than that. So that by itself is our single biggest expense, followed, of course, by the maintenance and utilities for this location.
How does the Central Florida Animal Reserve fit into the broader network of zoos across America?
Well, we would be considered a wildlife sanctuary. We don't do any breeding. None of the cats are sold here, and they stay here for the duration of their lives. Our role is to be part of the social safety net that just doesn't exist for big cats. When cats are in need, or if there are other organizations that are not able to make it financially, these animals have no home, and the zoos, unfortunately, can't take them because it's not part of their particular programs. So it's up to us as private individuals and nonprofit entities to make sure that they have a home and to provide them the care that they need.
So some of the animals you might have here, or the animals that might come to this operation, they would be domesticated animals, former pets? Would they be part of other kind of exhibits that have closed down?
Now, big cats are never domesticated, and they always have their wild instincts. They come from all kinds of backgrounds. We've got cats that were confiscations due to law enforcement actions, and they needed a home, and that was us. Cats that had been in the pet industry, and once they're no longer suitable for someone thinking they can control them, then they come to us. We've had cats that have been part of breeding operations, cats that have come from as far north and west as Oregon, really from all over the place. And it is a labor of love for the volunteers here who spend their time and energy to make this actually work.
And how many folks do you have running the place?
We have multiple cores, so there are about 10 people who really spend significant time and energy, full-time kind of time and energy on this work, in spite of having full-time jobs already. And then there's a halo of another probably 30 or 40 people who come and do labor out here, help feed the cats, do maintenance. But we're always looking for more. We're looking for people who can help us really take the next step in this organization's evolution.
Are you worried about continued funding for the place? Do you look at the $15,000 a month bill and think, how am I going to keep this going?
Every day, sometimes hourly to hourly. You know, because there aren't those state and federal funds and whatnot, we have to be able to convince people that their time, their energy, their treasure is worth investing in this. And as I've always told people, when they actually encounter a big cat, they're changed. They see the world a little bit different. And, you know, it's the giving season right now, and so the holiday season is huge for us in terms of being able to make it not just this month, but in the future months. It really is about legacy. And for everyone who would be listening now, they have to ask themselves, if you were looking at future generations, what would you want them to see to let them know what you found valuable today? And just as I would imagine that a portion of them should be donating to their public radio station, they should also be saying, you know, our natural world matters, and I want my kids and grandkids to know what it is to stand 4 feet away from a tiger.
Okay, so is this it as far as the size of the place? Are you looking to expand further?
Our expansion is going to really depend on the needs of the cats and the challenges that we face. Our mission has always been to create a platform that will address the challenges of big cats in the future, but provide value to society today. And in order to address those challenges, we will have to expand the operations. We want to gain enough support to put in a truly world-class visitor center so people can come and learn in an indoor environment, but also a customized veterinary center so we can address the unique medical concerns that come with these guys.
Dr. Simba Wiltz is the CEO of the Central Florida Animal Reserve. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for coming.
And you can find more details about the Central Florida Animal Reserve on our website, WMFE.org. And that interview first aired last November. When we visited the Central Florida Animal Reserve, there were 22 big cats. Since then, 4 more have arrived at the reserve. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Abe Abariah and Emily Lang. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can find us on the NPR One app. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.